content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. With a memory that brings endless joy. Amanda Elizabeth, reader. I just ended a serious relationship and moved twice, and I was putting in 16-hour days as a mental health and addiction worker. A friend who knew I was really stressed out came to pick me up for dinner, and we brought bird seeds so we could stop at a park to feed the ducks. It was exactly what I needed, to feel the fresh air and be in that peaceful state with the animals. Lorna Little, reader. I was in my 30s when I accidentally found out I was adopted, a discovery that left me feeling somewhat angry and lost. After 6 months of searching, I found my birth mother in England and eventually flew over to meet her and my two half-sisters. As nice as all that was, there was so much I didn't know. Then one of my sisters sent me a beautiful scrapbook with a picture of four women on the cover. It was filled with photos and information about our Scottish lineage, our grandparents and uncles. Each page had a wonderfully detailed letter describing each person's personality. That priceless object was a dose of healing when I needed it most. Natasha Kaja, reader. I left my home in Toronto to move to Los Angeles, where I knew no one, to pursue my dream of being an actress. My older brother was one of the only people who believed in me. When I got to California, I opened the trunk of my car and found a vision box he'd created for me, with almost 100 laminated photos of all my heroes and books that inspired me, plus an image he'd made of my name on a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. There were even pictures of puppies because I longed to have a dog one day. When I feel like giving up, that box reminds me of all the great people and things awaiting me on my journey. Cynthia Bond, author. Many years ago, I was living in a New York City hotel that I called the Roach Palace. My spirit had been crushed by a horrible breakup, and I couldn't eat or sleep. When my neighbor and dear friend Billy was moving out, the glass knob on the door to his room came off, and he gave it to me. It was like he was handing me hope that a door might open, and eventually it did. I survived. When Billy went to LA to fulfill his dream of being a comedy writer, I returned the knob to him. We've been passing that doorknob back and forth for 30 years, to usher in a new job, a new baby, the publication of my novel. It's on my desk now, and when I hand it to Billy, he'll tear up the way I do each time he gives it to me. Kathy Bates, actress. It's a gift to remember my mother's voice as she read to me when I was a child. I love to rest my head against her side and feel her voice resonating through her ribs. It seemed to me like I was putting my ear to an instrument being played, a cello, deep and soothing. Paula MacLean, author. When I was in my early 20s, I was working to put myself through college, and I was always broke. My sister Penny, in similar financial purgatory, spent the months before Christmas collecting department store samples of perfumes I could never afford. Chanel No. 5, Shalimar, Joy. Each little vial was wrapped in colored tissue, and they filled an entire shoebox. She gave me a year's worth of feeling pretty and put together, and I was so moved that she understood how deeply I wanted those things, all without my ever asking. Elizabeth Lesser, co-founder of the Omega Institute. I still have a scrap of paper given to me by Vincent Harding, a speechwriter for Martin Luther King, Jr. I was a young woman wrestling with questions about my future. Could I be both a spiritual seeker and a social activist? Harding wrote down these words attributed to the educator and theologian Howard Thurman. Don't ask yourself what the world needs. Ask yourself what makes you come alive and then go do that. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. Mbolo Mbu, author. I was recently on the phone with a dear friend, and as we were about to hang up, he said, "Remember, you are the loving expression of God." I almost fell down from the power of those words. Me, the loving expression of God. I've been carrying that awareness with me daily, a most beautiful gift. Gillian McLeod, reader. On my 19th birthday, my best friend and roommate, Sarah, gave me a copy of The Joy of Cooking. I'd moved away from home at age 16 and had been living with Sarah for a couple of years. She'd saved up tips from a restaurant job to pay for the book. It inspired the start of my love of cooking and was a true mark of independence. I'm still moved each time I read the inscription on the inside cover. You're like a sister to me. XO, Sarah. Catherine Tripp, reader. I was out of work, facing foreclosure and feeling worthless. To get my mind off things, a friend took me to a music festival where we stopped at a jewelry booth. I commented on a gorgeous necklace, and the salesman said he'd love to sell it to me. I told him I'd love to buy it, but I was about to be homeless. Half an hour later, I felt a tap on my shoulder. The man from the booth pressed the necklace into my hand and said, "I hope things get better soon." I realized then there is still great kindness in the world, and I do matter. After that, everything fell into place. I had the courage to call about a job, and I was hired. I found a program that would pay my mortgage for 18 months. One single act of kindness from a stranger changed my life forever. Jack Kornfield, co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society. Some time ago, I lived as a Buddhist monk in a forest monastery in Thailand, where I learned from the master, Ajahn Chah, a man of great wisdom who was very demanding. We'd walk for miles in freezing weather to collect alms for food, then sit meditating all night. I would be shivering, achy, exhausted. But one morning at 4 o'clock, at the very coldest moment, Cha smiled, winked at me, and said, "You can do it." And I knew then that I could. Peter Walsh, organization expert. A close friend and mentor once told me, "Indecision is a decision, a bad one." That gift became a golden rule in my life. Suzanne Tosconi, reader. I always wanted an easy-bake oven, but Santa never delivered one. When I was 34, my sister bought me one for Christmas. And yes, I made a cake. Jamie Quatro, author. The summer I turned 16, my father gave me his refurbished 69 Chevy Malibu convertible. Cherry red, chrome accents, V8 engine. A gift wasted on me at that age. What did I know about classic cars? The important thing was that Hannah and I could drive around Tucson with the top down. Hannah was my best friend, a year younger, but much taller, almost 5'10". Hannah's a knockout, my mother always said. And sure enough, that summer she signed with a modeling agency. She was already doing catalog work and some runway. A month after my birthday, Hannah and I went to the movies. On the way home, we stopped at a drive-thru, putting the fries on the seat between us to share. "Let's ride around a while," I said. It was a clear night, oven warm, full moon slung low over the desert. Taking a curve too fast, I hit a patch of dirt and fishtailed. What happened next is hazy. I plowed through a neighbor's landscape wall and drove into a full-grown palm. The front wheels came to rest halfway up the tree trunk. French fries on the floor, the dash in my lap, an impossible amount of blood on Hannah's face, flaps of skin hanging into her eyes. They took us in separate ambulances. In the ER, my parents spoke quietly. "Best plastic surgeon in the city. End of her modeling career." We'd been wearing lap belts, but the car didn't have shoulder harnesses. I'd cracked my cheekbone on the steering wheel. Hannah's forehead had split wide open on the dash. What would I say to her? When her mother, Sharon, came into my room, I started to cry, bracing myself for her anger. "I deserve it," I thought. She sat beside me and took my hand. "I rear-ended my best friend when I was your age," she said. "I totaled her car and mine." "I'm so sorry," was all I could get out. "You're both alive," she said. "The rest is window dressing." I started to protest, and she stopped me. "I forgive you. Hannah will, too." Hannah's stitches looked like an intricate road map tattooed on her forehead. She never modeled again. But Sharon's forgiveness allowed Hannah and me to get back in the car together that summer, to stay friends throughout high school and college, to be in each other's weddings, and to watch my 4 teenagers fawn over her 3 younger children. I think of her gift of forgiveness every time I'm tempted to resent someone for a perceived wrong. And whenever I see Hannah, the scars are so faded, no one else would notice, but in the sunlight, I can still see the faint shimmer just below her hairline. For me, after all these years, an imprint of grace. Making lasting memories. The key to giving a meaningful gift is to know your audience, says Lori DeShane, author of Tiny Buddha's 365 Tiny Love Challenges. When we show people we've paid attention, they know we care. Here are a few things to ask yourself about your loved one. How would he treat himself? My dad loves lobster but thinks it's too pricey, says DeShane. So I bought him a pair of lobsters and wrapped up a butter dish with a note that said, "Your gift is in the fridge." It was one of his favorite presents. What does she need? Use your sleuthing skills. Years ago, a filmmaker friend had a big premiere, but he was going to wear old, scuffed shoes because he couldn't afford new ones, says Oprah Daily editor-at-large and renowned gift-giver Gail King. So I found his size and bought him a pair. You would have thought I'd given him a car. What does he dream of? Look for a class on a subject that interests him, like photography or cooking, says Veronica Chambers of the blog giftymcgifty.com. A few sessions with a life coach can also be a fabulous gift. What makes her feel at home? I like to give a soft, glamorous, faux fur throw, says Chambers. It says, "I love you and I want you to be warm." In the accompanying card, tell her just that. Our next article by Carol V. Bell, Hamilton Kane, Lee Haber, and Wadzani Moot is titled Books to Read by the Fire. Another season, another crop of immersive books, whose pages we slowly turn while enjoying the bite of autumn's air and the warmth of wood as it crackles and burns. Number one, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabriel Zevin. Stow away your iPhone and settle in with one of the year's most ingenious debuts, a genre-bending novel probing friendship, tech culture, and emerging art forms. As kids, Sam and Sadie bond over a shared passion for gaming and the compulsion to shake loose the confines of the physical. Over three tumultuous decades, they become best friends, then business partners, then rivals, forging a platonic relationship more intimate than lovers. Number two, All That's Left Unsaid by Tracy Lean. This thoroughly immersive literary mystery follows a rookie reporter on a quest to get justice for her slain sibling. Kai Tran has worked to distance herself from her Vietnamese-Australian community, but when her straight-arrow 17-year-old brother Denny dies violently, she can't help being drawn back in. Lean, a former journalist, exposes the conditional nature of the welcome afforded Asian immigrants in ostensibly liberal places. Number three, Musical Tables by Billy Collins. Collins' short poems warm the soul. Like koans and haiku, these micro-lyrics roam a range of tone and feeling, from elegies to epiphanies to bone-dry witticisms. In New York Directions, for instance, he points the reader toward Bleecker Street in Greenwich Village, between bleak and bleakest. His formal compression is deft, his insights arresting. Number four, Love Marriage by Monica Ali. In her fiercely imagined novel set in London, the author of Brick Lane peels away the illusions we conjure when our core relationships are threatened. Yasmin, daughter of a straight-laced, striving Muslim clan, is engaged to Joe, who hails from an affluent, progressive, narcissistic tribe. As the family's attempt at peaceful merger, crisis looms. Joe's mother once posed nude for a photo as a kind of feminist statement. Culture clashes, political satire, Oedipal conflicts. They're all here in this romp of a book. Number five, Wintering by Catherine May. Written as linked essays pre-COVID pandemic, May's supple memoir limns the season of Hygge as she chronicles an unexpected reckoning in the wake of a medical crisis. Hunkered down with husband and son in southeast England, she bridges the outer world with inner reflection, guiding us from geothermal pools in volcanic Iceland to a Sancta Lucia service to the beaches near home, a gorgeously edifying work aglazed with insight. Number six, The Sleeping Car Porter by Suzette Mayer. Mayer marries the spark of same-sex attraction with the glamour of the Orient Express. In 1929, Porter Baxter is on duty from Montreal to Vancouver when a mudslide delays the journey. He must cater to increasingly unruly passengers who treat him as invisible. Black and secretly gay, he harbors ambitions for a less subservient life. Mary evokes the mystique of transcontinental travel and the tumult of lives on the margins in this much-anticipated period novel. All aboard. Number 7, Belle Greene by Alexandra LaPierre. In the 1900s, Bella da Costa Greene, daughter of a black activist, decided to pass for white, assimilating into wealthy New York society. This novelization of her luxuriant, if fraught career, Edith Wharton's Gilded Age meets W.E.B. Du Bois's The Talented Tenth, captivates throughout. An expert reader, Greene managed financier J.P. Morgan's private library and entered previously inaccessible social circles. But meanwhile, was her secret truly safe? Number 8, Counterfeit by Kirsten Chen. Looks can be deceiving in handbags and people. But if you're a sucker for a subversive long con novel in which the not-so-good guys come out on top, then you'll find the caper concocted by ex-Stanford classmates Ava Wong and Winnie Fang as delectable as the Birkin bags the pair are faking. Or just settle in for such sumptuous descriptors as eyes that are anime character huge with thick double eyelid folds, expertly contoured in coppery tones framed by premium lash extensions, soft and full as a fur pelt. Number 9, Dinosaurs by Lydia Millett. Nothing delights like a sublime novel cunningly crafted by a writer at the height of her powers. Gil is a wealthy, laconic white guy who, in the wake of a doomed romance, abandons his life in Manhattan for a castle in a normie Phoenix neighborhood. A picture-perfect family inhabits the glass house next door, gradually drawing him into the dramas of their lives. Millett's previous novel, A Children's Bible, was a finalist for the 2020 National Book Award. Here she metes out, in terse, calibrated prose, a tale of menace and redemption and the wall that separates them like a clear pane. Number 10, The It Girl by Ruth Ware. There's nothing cozier than a glass of mulled cider paired with a town and gown thriller. The trope of the captivating fair-haired girl looms large in this spellbinding British novel, reminiscent of Colin Dexter and Agatha Christie. A leading light of suspense fiction delivers all the frissons. Number 11, 3 by Valerie Perrin. Perrin's spooky, mesmerizing novel carves away the skin of French society with the adroit technique of a Michelin star chef. In the late 1980s, Adrian, Etienne, and Nina form a rebellious clique determined to escape their small town for Paris. 30 years later, when a car with a corpse is dredged from a local lake, a journalist vows to crack the cold case, ensnaring the estranged threesome. A continental cousin to Donna Tartt and Tana French, Perrin spins a penetrating tale of our expectations and dreads. Number 12, How to Calm Your Mind by Chris Bailey. A leading productivity expert helps us ring in 2023 with an elegant, prescriptive plan for a healthier, tranquil path forward. After rebounding from his own burnout, Bailey devised a clear-eyed, concise method that marries science and self-help. He's equally proficient in probing the roles of serotonin and endorphins while charting concrete steps and chapters titled The Mindset of More and Heights of Stimulation. Slow down, breathe, and submerge into these pages. Number 13, The Birdcatcher by Gail Jones. After Jones' 1975 debut novel, Corregidora, came out, Toni Morrison, Jones' editor, declared, "No novel about any black woman could ever be the same after this." Jones became a literary darling until disappearing from the scene for 21 years. She reemerged last year with the epic Palmares, a Pulitzer finalist, and this fall comes The Birdcatcher, a novel in which a gifted sculptor repeatedly tries to kill her husband as their friend looks on. Brilliant and incendiary, Jones' pairing of tragedy with dark humor cuts to the bone. Number 14, The Violin Conspiracy by Brendan Slocum. Why binge Netflix when an atmospheric suspense novel will break your cabin fever? Slocum's debut is a savvy exploration of race, class, and family wrapped up in a heist novel. Raekwon is an underdog and an anomaly, a world-class, albeit underestimated, black classical violinist from North Carolina. He grew up poor but found a precious musical heirloom in his grandmother's attic. But just weeks before a career-making contest, his prized instrument goes missing, and most of the prime suspects are relatives. Thus begins a quest for justice that will absorb readers until the proverbial last page. Number 15, Upstream by Mary Oliver. In her shimmering lyrical collection of essays, the late poet, winner of both the National Book Award and Pulitzer, transports us outside as we cozy up indoors, recounting walks among woods and hummocks and beaches, gathering herself into the solace of the land and sea around her. Our next article by Tish Durkin is titled The Reluctant Hostess. After all those canceled and postponed plans, you want to invite people over, but it's been a long, weird while. From an everything but dinner get-together to a last-minute shindig, we've got four ways to get you back to hosting and toasting. There are many reasons not to throw a party, especially now that we have hit the is-it-mostly-kinda-over stage of the pandemic. Just the question, should we have a bunch of people over, leads to more questions, all of them nettled with cranky uncertainties. What if a new variant invites itself along with my guests? How much does the temperature have to go down and the COVID numbers go up before I'm dealing with outdoor heaters? Does Miss Manners have a rule about rapid testing? And it's not as if these new trepidations have done anything to banish the old ones. Could COVID vanish and we'd still be worrying that our home is too cramped, our time too short, our cooking too blah? But the reasons we most need to entertain right now flow directly from all the reasons we are most afraid to. The very fact that the pandemic forced us into such leaden isolation only sharpens our craving for light communion. You don't need money, a mansion, or Ina Garten's way with Groton to throw a fantastic party. You do need a COVID-combating plan, negative tests required, outdoor drinks, a picnic dinner. And you need a concept. Not a concept as in an all-girl luau or Christmas in July, although I keep meaning to do that, but as an idea that acknowledges any shortcomings you may be dealing with and turns them into selling points. Take it from me, someone with absolutely no decorating, cleaning, organizing, or culinary claims to fame. There are four parties that anyone can throw this season. Number one, random right-now cocktails. Actually, this originated as poverty cocktails, as in, I'm in poverty, you bring the cocktails. But the solvent can try it too. Sad story. I was headed for a 20-something birthday. I had just quit my job to become a freelance writer. I was living in a basement studio. None of my neighbors knew me, let alone my birthday, and there were no colleagues to drop hints to. So I decided I was one of those mature people who just hate a big fuss being made about their birthday. Napoleon en route to Russia had fewer delusions. Around noon, dank little drops of sadness started to drip down like an overhead leak, and by sunset, I was up to my neck in it. Down but not out, I started dialing. To anyone at his or her telephone, I posed the same question. Can you come over and celebrate my birthday with me this very night, in a couple of hours, in fact? And if so, might you perhaps bring a cake and maybe some wine or champagne? Since no one had any notice, almost no one was free to fall for this. So I ended up with one ex-colleague, a 60-ish Irish friend of my mother's, the guy upstairs whom I had never met, and three or four others, none of whom knew each other. It was tacky. It was pathetic. It was one of the most hilariously excellent times I have ever had. Now, unless you're really young, really poor, and really bummed about your birthday, I don't recommend making everyone bring everything. But I heartily recommend throwing very small, very low-stress, very last-minute parties, and doing so very often, as I did for years after that first foray. For as I later realized, my original approach, desperate and accidental though it was, had several built-in virtues. One, it automatically weeded out anyone who stood on ceremony, as well as anyone who didn't really want to come. Moreover, the last-minute factor ruled out my finding a whole matched set of guests, colleagues, or family, free to accept, and resulted in a refreshingly motley crew. People simply couldn't get caught up in the same old blather about work or politics or whatever. They had no same old anything in common. Random right-now cocktails free you to ignore the, oh, if I invite this person, I have to invite that person rulebook, which swallows so many guest lists whole and sucks the spark out of so many gatherings. This isn't a wedding, it's a whim. Number two, the soiree and shifts. While still living in that basement, in which I could fit about 8 people standing straight up, I wanted to throw a Christmas party for about 50. Using the rule of thumb that 1/4 of invitees will decline outright, I calculated that I would actually need space for about 38 people. No problem. Never imagining the pandemic that would one day furnish a whole new reason to keep numbers sparse, I invited everyone, just not all for the same time. 12 or maybe 13 invitations said 4 to 6 o'clock, implying a tea time kind of thing. Nobody who showed up complained when offered cocktails. 12 invitations said 5 to 7, 12 said 6 to 8, and so on. This way, the place never got too crowded. Fresh blood was guaranteed to flow in once an hour. Yes, some people overstayed and overlapped, but only because they really wanted to, and there's always room for that. Number 3, back-to-back dinner parties. Then again, perhaps you're in the mood for something less musical chairs. That's when I turn to the small, slow dinner. Text 1 to 3 people or slip a note under their doors asking them to come over and brave your attempt at home cooking, and they will show up, tickled and touched to have been asked. So tickled and touched, in fact, that if the food or anything else is a disaster, but you remain a delight as ever, they'll actually like you better for it. That said, you will inevitably go to some effort to get ready. You will put clean soap and towels in the bathroom, you will vacuum and dust, and unless COVID has miraculously avoided your locale, you will put rapid tests in the foyer and a space heater and table on the porch. If you're going for an extra touch of class, you may put out some flowers or iron a tablecloth. And after your guests have come and gone, assuming that you have loaded the dishwasher and swept the kitchen floor, you will wake up the next morning with a house that still looks much better than usual and a refrigerator full of fabulous leftovers. There's only one logical response. Have another small dinner party that night. All you have to do is A, plan the first party for a Friday night so you can have the second one on a Saturday night, and B, make something that will not look or taste like leftovers. Beef bourguignon or spaghetti bolognese will actually taste better on night 2. Whether you're making or buying the dessert, choose something that is served individually rather than something elaborate that people are supposed to drool over before it's cut. On Saturday, all you have to do is inspect the tablecloth for any really bad stains, cover any not really bad stains with the dishes or some candlesticks, and fire up the space heater or replenish the tests in the foyer. Open the dishwasher, and instead of putting the dishes, glasses, and cutlery away, put it all back on the table. Spritz the flowers, reheat the leftovers. When the doorbell rings, open the door, and voila, you've doubled your entertaining while barely adding to your effort. Number 4, the skip dinner party. But what if you want tons of people, tons of food, and tons of time? For this one, you'll also need tons of evidence that the COVID factor is minimal in your area and absent among your guests. Health protocols established. The problem with a dinner is, unless you have a dining area baronial proportions, it's very hard to seat more than 6 or 8 people or organize a buffet for more than 10 or 12. The problem with a larger stand-up and scarf finger food cocktail party is it's only supposed to last about 2 hours. Apart from the 1 or 2 super tipplers who can be counted on to be licking the salt out of the nut dishes while crooning my way into the wee hours, everyone will clear out in time to go to dinner elsewhere. And that can be a real letdown for the hosts, who will have gone to tremendous effort getting ready, only to spend the night taking people's coats and then handing them back again. The solution, the skip dinner party. Lots of drinks, lots of hors d'oeuvres, and lots of desserts, all made ahead of time and strategically placed everywhere, along with any necessary forks, plates, or glasses. Granted, the host will still need to do some passing and replenishing of food, but that's intermittently over the course of a nice long party, not feverishly for 2 hours straight. As for the guests, they will have plentiful options in terms of tastes and timing. Those who want to come and go before dinner may do so. Those who want to come after dinner may do so. And those who want to keep talking and drinking for hours on end can do so while continually filling their stomachs, on savories, on sweets, or on both. At least that's how it's supposed to go. I won't tell you everything that went wrong at my last skip dinner party. Let's just say it involved small pieces of bread, small pieces of meat, and timing. It turns out that although the recipe may say it takes just 30 seconds to sear the filet, one should allow considerably longer to sear enough of it for 50 people, lest one find oneself frantically plastering bits of meat to rounds of frantically buttered baguette and damming the Merlot glaze while the doorbell rings and rings. But I will get it right the next time. Or the time after that. Our next article by Isabel Burton is titled, Walking in a Winter Wonderland. Yes, it's cold. Sure, there's the snow and ice, but research shows that these conditions make strolling this season all the more healthful. delivering a higher calorie burn, better overall health, less stress, and even a sunnier mood. Shia Harris, a former public school teacher, considers outdoor walks to be an essential part of her self-care routine. These walks ground me and allow me to release any tension or stress I'm feeling. Walking reminds me of the small wonders in life, like the birds chirping, she says. In fact, Harris so believes in the physical and psychological power of walking and spending time outdoors, she's taken on the role of National Program Director for Outdoor Afro, an organization committed to celebrating Black connections and leadership in nature. There, she leads 100-plus volunteers in outdoor adventures. Harris has the right idea, according to a range of experts. Taking walks can level up your health. Do it outside, and you'll reap a whole host of additional benefits. But what about as the weather gets colder? Well, it turns out that if you wander in the winter, when the temps are low and the conditions a bit harsher, your body and brain gain significant long-lasting upgrades. Here, everything you need to know about braving the cold for a stroll. Walking is great exercise. Besides burning calories and maintaining muscle, just 2.5 hours of walking a week, 21 minutes a day, is enough to bump up your heart health, lower blood pressure, and reduce the odds of certain cancers and chronic disease, according to a report published by Harvard Health. And the physical perks manifest in more surprising ways as well. Research shows that body weight on your feet while exercising compresses the major arteries, increasing blood flow to the brain, explains Joanna Hall, a walking coach and the creator and founder of Walk Active, an educational walking program. Walking on uneven surfaces drastically improves balance, adds Tina Vindham, founder and president of the Outdoor Fitness Institute, citing a study out of the Oregon Research Institute. One of the goals in walking outdoors is to develop your foot sensitivity. Reflexologists believe that the uneven landscape can stimulate acupressure points in the soles of the feet to relieve pain, improve sleep patterns, and enhance overall well-being, says Vindham. A basic stroll can also be the antidote to the lethargy that tends to set in during these darker months. Dozens of studies find that about 90% of people report feeling more energetic after a single bout of low to moderate intensity exercise, lasting from about 20 to 75 minutes, says Patrick O'Connor, PhD, a kinesiology professor at the University of Georgia, who has studied the exercise-energy link. Research suggests it's changes in several neurotransmitters like dopamine and norepinephrine that likely contribute to post-exercise energy. What's more, studies have found that feelings of energy are higher after exercising outside compared to indoors, even when the intensity and duration is the same. And that energy seems to last. One study found that women who took a moderate to vigorous walk around 8 a.m. were more active for the rest of the day. Not only that, but they ate less as a result. Another study made a key connection between exercise and appetite suppression, possibly due to the production of a hormone called growth differentiation factor 15, or GDF-15, which may help control feelings of hunger and responses to food. Low temps boost the benefits. Cold weather may invite you to stay huddled inside, but it's actually a reason to nudge yourself out. Exposure to low temperatures has been proven to shift body fat composition by activating production of brown fat, a healthy type of fat that burns a surplus of calories to create heat and manage body temperature, according to research from the National Institutes of Health. In fact, one study in the American Journal of Human Biology found that people burn 34% more calories when they hike in cold weather than when doing so in warmer conditions. Add to that science from NIH that finds exercising when it's frosty is linked to greater endurance, plus the cold is associated with lower inflammation, better quality sleep, muscle and joint health, a stronger immune system, walking in winter actually increases the number of immune cells in your body, and a more positive mood. Certain neurotransmitters, epinephrine and norepinephrine, triggered by cold, make us more alert and motivated to move. And they linger, so post-shivering, you'll still feel energized, focused, and upbeat. Even the discomfort is good for you. The temporary hardship adds a challenge to contend with, which jumpstarts something called hormesis, a type of good stress that strengthens your body and mind. Getting out of your own head to deal with the conditions bolsters your mental fitness, making you better able to stay calm and clear-headed when facing real-world stressors, as does navigating your unpredictable surrounding landscape, like watching for icy or muddy patches. Essentially, the cold acts like a workout for your brain. More on those mental gains. Exercise has one of the most profound impacts on psychological health, confirms Jacob Meyer, PhD, director of the Well-Being and Exercise Laboratory at Iowa State University. It's been shown to reduce anxiety, stress, and depression, both in the short time you're moving and over the long term when you establish a regular routine. He points out that this effect is especially powerful in the colder, more dreary months when seasonal affective disorder can take hold. When winter causes people to move less, even a small amount of time spent walking outside can have a bigger positive impact than usual, he explains. When it comes to mental well-being, the environmental factor is real, contributing to 70% of our stress, says Vindham. The shocking reality is that most people spend over 90% of their waking hours indoors. In today's automated world of technology and urban living, our bonds with nature have been fractured, and as a result, people are more rushed, stressed, overweight, and depressed than ever before, she says. But perhaps equally surprising, this is an issue that's easily rectified. You don't need access to the woods or the seaside to benefit from an outdoor walk. Even just exploring your neighborhood, a local park, or any path will change your mindset for the better. An app like AllTrails helps you find local trails to walk and provides you with all the data you need to create your routine. When you're wandering, tune into the sounds around you. One study has shown that listening to nature sounds, like birds, crunching leaves, or snow, can increase relaxation by a further 30%. Although spring and summer may seem like obvious times to enjoy a scenic walk, the winter months provide just as much beauty and sense of awe. One study out of the University of Michigan found that people enjoyed the same boosts in focus and even memory when they walked outdoors in a frigid 25 degrees in January, as they did during a sunny 80-degree stroll in summer. Gear up. We have a saying in outdoor fitness, there's no such thing as inappropriate weather, only inappropriate clothing, says Vindham. Dressing appropriately is the best defense against a drop in your body temperature and the ticket to a great workout in chilly weather. Cold weather dressing is all about layers and fabrics. Avoid wearing cotton, which loses much of its insulating capabilities when it's wet. Cotton clothing can actually contribute to hypothermia. Technical fabrics, such as Polartec and Gore-Tex, are created to function in frigid temperatures. Follow Vindham's guidelines for maintaining your core temperature and protecting your body. Number 1, layer clothing. Several thin layers work better than one heavy layer. Layers are also easier to add and remove to regulate temperature. Number 2, cover your head. A good amount of body heat can be lost through your head. Always wear a hat or a headband. Number 3, wear gloves. To insulate and protect your hands, choose lightweight gloves that provide the greatest warmth and flexibility, preferably with rubberized or leather strips on the palm for gripping equipment. Number 4, cover your mouth. A scarf or a mask will help to warm the air before you breathe it. This is especially important if you have respiratory problems such as asthma, which are irritated by cold air. Number 5, stay dry. Wet, damp clothing from either perspiration or precipitation significantly increases heat loss. And number 6, keep your feet dry. Choose socks made of polypropylene, wool, or another fabric that wicks moisture and retains insulation when feet get wet. Want to bring your pup? No problem. It's generally safe to bring your dog along for a winter walk as long as it's not below freezing outside. That's 32 degrees Fahrenheit. If it's rainy or snowy, you may want to consider a waterproof sweater or jacket to keep them warm and dry. Oh, and beware of salt. If sidewalks have recently been salted, those little pebbles can lodge between dog paws and be quite painful. You can slip dog booties on their paws before heading outside to keep your furry friend protected. Our next article by Eleanor Hitt is titled Visions of Sugar Plum Fairies and Past Lives. I was leaving the theater late, close to 11, the last to descend from our dressing room at the top of a winding staircase backstage. The stage was empty and dark except for the ghost light, the industry name for a single bulb left on center stage. The other lighting fixtures, curtains, and wings had been hoisted up into the flies, exposing brick, large set pieces, thick ropes. I pause just behind the ghost light, savoring the uncommon solitude of an empty theater. I was 20 and dancing in the annual month-long run of the Nutcracker at the Pennsylvania Ballet. Rare moments of stillness like this one punctuated the constant forward momentum. The young women of the company's general corps de ballet worked the hardest, and the production depended on us. Every night we danced George Balanchine's iconic steps and the Waltz of the Snowflakes and the Waltz of the Flowers. Both require the precision of the Rockettes and the stamina of long-distance runners. On stage, we danced in clouds of pink tulle or leapt into blizzards of fake snow. Backstage, it was acupuncture and physical therapy, antibiotics for infected blisters, and 6 Advil every 2 hours. We danced 40 or more shows in the Nutcracker per season, matinees and evening shows on the weekends, and one show on most weeknights. We all became regulars in all the shops and cafes around the theater, and everyone in the vicinity was abuzz with the excitement of Nutcracker season. After shows on Christmas or New Year's Eve, sisters and aunts would crowd around the stage door, whisking me off for a warm meal and a glass of champagne at the bistro nearby. That December of 2013, I was recovering from the second of 2 invasive surgeries on broken bones in my right foot. 4 months earlier, I had been learning how to walk again. 1 month later, I was putting on point shoes again for the first time and rehearsing to dance in the Nutcracker. I came back strong. I was the only company member cast to dance Flowers in every show. And yet, with my foot hardly recovered, the excitement, the exhaustion, the responsibility, everything felt precarious. I found a sense of permanency instead in novels, toting to the theater the brothers Karamazov, Willa Cather's stories about opera singers in Chicago, and Frank O'Hara's poetry. Now I can see the books offered me the freedom of thought that dancing in the corps de ballet generally discouraged. Dancers are constantly asked to sacrifice authentic style and expression for the homogeny of the corps, where dancers are rarely welcome to articulate their pain, opinions, or ideas. Perhaps this is why I found literature attractive. I was looking for a literal language to express myself. Now I can see the quiet moment at the ghost light and see it for what it was. I had been balancing 2 possible lives, and that balance began to shift. Since long before I was seriously injured, I had been earning my degree at Columbia. I began while finishing my training at the School of American Ballet in New York. Today, it's commonplace for dancers to earn a bachelor's degree on the side in preparation for their next life offstage. But even just 5 and 10 years ago, there were only a few of us who took it seriously. I retired from dance in my mid-20s and am now a doctoral student in English at Harvard. But I still take ballet class, now in a cavernous, repurposed church across from Harvard Yard, returning to the bar like a lapsed worshiper to the pew. My body's own memory surprises me. My back bends easily and my legs kick high. I'm strong. I could take a semester off and do the Nutcracker, I find myself saying at English department parties. In 2020, everyone had to take time away from the Nutcracker. Now seeing my peers return to the stage almost makes me want to, too. This year, a friend invited me to see him perform the Nutcracker with the Miami City Ballet at the Kennedy Center. Once again, I found myself in the Opera House, where I debuted at age 10 as a party girl number 4 in the Joffrey's Ballet Nutcracker. Every time I performed on that stage since, I would take a moment to greet the youngest ghost of my dancing self at the top left corner, where I was once stationed for most of Joffrey's first act. Now from the audience, I still looked at that empty spot. That tiny party girl with tight blonde curls rose up before me fully formed in a blue dress, rocking her doll, and I couldn't look away. As the Nutcracker continued to spin on, I thought of all the roles I'd danced and every step that could go wrong, feeling again the teacher's too hard grip on my thin arm as he manhandled me into the proper positions. I remember just as well the triumph and ease with which my favorite partners and I would dive into the difficult jumps and lifts. Some form of poetic expression is possible on stage, as clear as any I study on the page. Still, as I chatted with my friends from Miami after their performance, I felt estranged from their world. Now I spend the December days and nights I used to spend on stage in a room that houses the English department's book collection. It's up a winding staircase on the top floor of Harvard's Widener Library. Here I return often to a book that has been a favorite in graduate school, Nella Larsen's Passing. The opening scene is obscure and impressionistic. The main character sits down for tea and sees a woman who looks uncannily familiar. She observes in her in parts, red lips, soft dress, floral perfume, the grace of a dancer. It's unclear whether she sees, in this strange doppelganger, some character version of herself or a haunting from the past. I slip into characters like this one and move, exhilarated about their world, as if returning to a familiar role on stage. I suppose that's the thing about life-changing choices. You sometimes see the shadow of a self who could have been trailing you like a ghost. It's a type of beautiful I may never feel again. She looks confident, yet a nerd, ready to step on stage for Flowers or Sugar Plum, whichever role her career has led her toward. But that's her business, not mine, so I let her fall out of focus, knowing that all I can do now is rebuild my relationship with ballet in some healthier, happier way. This will mean redefining my relationship with the Nutcracker, too. Each year, like clockwork, there is a chance to find a way back. Many nights in December, I have walked down the winding stairs, the last to leave the library. It's dark, and a few street lamps light the paths across from an eerie glow. Campus at these hours is quiet, and my solitude is filled with satisfaction. Our next article, by Nadine Jolie Courtney, is titled The Most Magical Christmas Towns and Villages Across the World. Think that there's no place like home for the holidays? We have a feeling that our list of the best Christmas towns, from a city in Indiana named Santa Claus, really, to a village in Vermont filled with old-fashioned charm, to a festival in Tennessee where you'll find Victorian-era treats and Ebenezer Scrooge, to the most wonderful winter wonderlands in the world, will make you think twice. Carolers, hot chocolate, holiday decorations galore. Celebrating Christmas is an art form, and these small towns have perfected it, spreading cheer every November and December. A Santa in the square? Child's play. Here, villages turn storybook Christmases straight out of a Dickens novel into a reality, taking celebrations to the next level in the form of parades, unique trees, miles of ornate light displays, pageants, sleigh rides, and enough chestnuts and cocoa to send the elves into hibernation. If you're planning a holiday getaway and looking for the best Christmas town to visit in the U.S. or in the world, these Christmas villages are guaranteed to make you feel like you're stepping inside your favorite holiday flick, or more specifically, a literal Hallmark movie. Just be sure to check websites for the latest updates on events, as some may still have coronavirus precautions in place. Number 1, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Tucked in Colorado Springs is an amusement park called the North Pole. Here you'll not only find what else, Santa's workshop, but there's also rides, plenty of twinkling lights, and more, all at the foot of Pikes Peak. That's not all the town boasts, though. You can ride the Polar Express train that takes you straight to said theme park, plus enjoy the annual Festival of Lights parade that marks the illumination of the town's streets and kicks off a series of festive holiday events. Number 2, College Station, Texas. They say everything's bigger in Texas, and that's certainly true at Santa's Wonderland, one of the biggest Christmas celebrations in the state. The College Station locale is home to dozens of magical holiday experiences, from an illuminated Santa hayride to an oversized gingerbread village, to a live nativity scene to a cowboy Christmas corral. Of course, revelers will also get the chance to meet the man in the big red suit, too. Number 3, Solvang, California. In the Santa Ynez Mountains outside Santa Barbara, this tiny Danish village celebrates Christmas with ample cheer during its annual Jule Fest. Events include the Skålstrål wine and beer walk, candlelight tours, a nativity pageant, a holiday concert, and the Jule Fest parade. Keep an eye peeled for the Jule Nis, festive gnomes with clues leading toward holiday prizes. Number 4, Bad Ragaz, Switzerland. The Swiss town of Bad Ragaz kicks off its yearly Christmas season in late November with a ceremonial festival of lights, illuminating the 131-foot-tall sequoia tree on the lawn of Grand Resort Bad Ragaz, supposedly the tallest living Christmas tree in Europe. Other events hosted at the picturesque village's Grand Resort include several Christmas markets, multiple concerts, dinners, parties, and processions, and a Russian Christmas gala. Number 5, Woodstock, Vermont. Woodstock, Vermont is a magical place all year long, but perhaps even more so at Christmas time, when the quintessential New England town turns into a holly jolly hotspot straight out of a Hallmark movie. In fact, the network's last Vermont Christmas was set there. During its annual Wassail weekend, you can tour Woodstock's most charming historic homes, travel by horse-drawn wagon to see the town's quaint covered bridges and snowy vistas, shop for locally made holiday presents, attend a variety of world-class concerts, line the streets for the colorful equestrian parade, and gather for the lighting of the town's tree, Yule log, and hundreds of luminaries. Need a place to stay? Make sure to check out the postcard-pretty Woodstock Inn and Resort. Number 6, Franklin, Tennessee. Nearly 100,000 people travel to Franklin, Tennessee each year for its Dickens of a Christmas, a two-day festival featuring over 200 musicians, dancers, and characters from Charles Dickens' stories. Other highlights include a Victorian Christmas village, carriage rides, and a maker's village. Number 7, Leavenworth, Washington. Dreaming of a white Christmas? Look no further than Leavenworth, Washington, a small town tucked away in the Cascade Mountains. For 3 weekends leading up to Christmas, the village's snow-covered Bavarian-style buildings are illuminated by more than 500,000 twinkling lights, and the sounds of handbell ringers, marching bands, and carolers fill the streets. In addition to ooing and aahing over the breathtaking display, visitors can also ski, sled, or tube down the Powdery Mountainside, take horse-drawn carriage rides, and stop by the annual Chris Kindle Market for handmade gifts and steaming cups of glue wine, aka spiced wine, or cocoa. Number 8, Aarhus, Denmark. Denmark's second largest city, the quaint destination of Aarhus, is a Christmas dream. The town boasts thousands of lights on its Strøget High Street, with delights including a Christmas market selling Danish specialties, the exterior of department stores selling wrapped up like a gift, Christmas tree-lined streets in the Latin Quarter, and a panorama of Danish Christmas throughout the ages at the Old Town Museum. Number 9, Natchitoches, Louisiana. Natchitoches may be a small Louisiana town, but it celebrates Christmas in a big way. The holiday prep gets underway in June when 300,000 glittering lights and 100 riverbank decorations are tested in anticipation of the annual Festival of Lights, which has been running for more than 90 years. During the 6-week holiday festival, visitors can also participate in docent-led tours of historic homes, shop at Louisiana's oldest general store, Cafe Frederick General Mercantile, pick up creamy eggnog daiquiris at Maggio's Packaged Liquors, a drive-through beverage barn, munch on the town's iconic piping hot meat pies, watch fireworks light up the sky over Cane River Lake, and stay at the Steel Magnolia House Bed and Breakfast, which served as part of the film's set. Number 10, Williamsburg, Virginia. Calling itself the best Christmas town in America, Colonial Williamsburg particularly shines at Christmas time. Traditions abound, such as caroling by torchlight, a gun salute display, and every home in the historic area lighting a candle in their windows, dating back to the days of the founding fathers. As far as lights, the area can't be beat, with Busch Gardens donning 10 million lights for the largest display in North America. And the community Christmas tree lighting ceremony at Market Square is a must. Number 11, St. Augustine, Florida. When you think of the most dazzling light displays across the globe, places like Hong Kong and Madrid probably come to mind. But what about St. Augustine, Florida? According to National Geographic, it's one of the top 10 places worldwide. That's because every year, more than 3 million twinkling bulbs, each white per city ordinance, drape all 20 blocks of the city's historic district during the annual Nights of Lights Festival. Guests can view the brilliant spectacle by trolley, train, boat, helicopter, horse-drawn carriage, and of course, foot. Even more brilliant, you can enjoy the whole show without wearing a coat, hat, and gloves. Number 13, Newport Beach, California. Drop your anchor at Newport Harbor for the annual Newport Beach Christmas Boat Parade, which started more than a century ago with a single gondola and a few canoes. Now it's one of the biggest holiday celebrations on the water, with owners of more than 150 boats, from kayaks to 100-foot super yachts, spending months and thousands of dollars decorating their vessels with everything from LED lights and inflatable characters to live bands and air cannons. After setting sail for 5 consecutive nights in December, owners of the brightly decorated boats compete for prizes in a range of categories, including animation and humor and originality. Number 14, Alexandria, Virginia. For a traditional American Christmas, head to Alexandria, Virginia, where the old town streets and 18th century row houses bustle with good cheer each December. Festive seekers can find carolers, handbell choirs, ample lights, and decorations. What's more, nearby you'll find Mount Vernon, home to Aladdin, a Christmas camel, as well as a colonial Christmas experience. Number 15, Duluth, Minnesota. During the Christmas season, Duluth, Minnesota seems to shine just a little bit brighter, literally. The festivities officially kick off the Friday before Thanksgiving with the Christmas City of the North nighttime parade that includes 24 marching bands, 70 businesses, several dance groups, and even Santa. But the headliner is the Bentleyville Tour of Lights, America's largest free walk-through Christmas light display, in which displays of local attractions, as well as a 12-foot Christmas tree, are lit up by more than 4 million multicolored lights, while volunteers offer hot chocolate, cookies, and popcorn along the way. Pro tip, the port city averages 70 inches of fluffy powder each year, so be prepared to dash through the snow, unless you're taking a ride on the Christmas City Express, a vintage train wrapped in holiday lights and decor. Santa Claus, Indiana. With a name like Santa Claus, how could this small Indiana town not be full of seasonal tidings? Celebrations include the annual Christmas parade, a Santa Claus arts and crafts show, a German-inspired Das Nikolaus Fest, and the Santa Claus Museum and Village, where children can write letters to Saint Nick. So be prepared to dash through the snow, unless you're taking a ride on the Christmas City Express, a vintage train wrapped in holiday lights and decor. Santa Claus, Indiana. With a name like Santa Claus, how could this small Indiana town not be full of seasonal tidings? Celebrations include the annual Christmas parade, a Santa Claus arts and crafts show, a German-inspired Das Nikolaus Fest, and the Santa Claus Museum and Village, where children can write letters to Saint Nick. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.